Do it. You should have done it last week. Ruby chuckles and says,
Next week?
Yes, says Laurel, smiling. Next week is fine. It's always a quiet time. She takes her mother's hands and says, We're having a big Christmas Eve do. At Paul and Bonnie's? Hannah will be there. Jake? My new boyfriend? His daughter? I wish you could come.
No, thank you, says Ruby. And Laurel laughs.
No, she says. I don't blame you.
How is new boyfriend?
The smile freezes on Laurel's face. She doesn't know how to answer the question, so she smiles and says, He's wonderful. It's all good. But as the words leave her mouth, she can feel the heavy lie of them. Her mother feels it too.
Good,
she repeats, concernedly. Yes, she says. Good. Her mother nods, just once.
If you say so, she says. If you say so.
Laurel calls Jake when she leaves her mother's care home. He picks up the call within two ringtones. Mum, he says, a note of concern in his voice. Everything's fine, she says. Not an emergency. I just wanted to say hello.
I'm really sorry, Mum, he starts immediately. I'm really sorry about me and Blue and what we said to you the other day. It was out of order.
No, Jake, honestly, it's fine. I'm sorry I overreacted. I think I was just so shocked to find myself in a relationship after so long I was a bit raw. Just wanted everything to be perfect, you know? And of course nothing's perfect, is it? No, says Jake, in a voice full of things he'd like to say, but can't.
No. That's true.
Am I seeing you tomorrow? She says. At Bonnie's?
Yes, he replies. We'll be there.
You know Floyd will be there too. Will that be a problem?
No,
he says, overly assured, she feels.
No. It will be fine.
She takes a breath, ready to get to the point of her call. Is Blue there? She says. I wondered if we could have a word.
Yeah?
Says Jake.
Yeah, she's here. You're not going to...
No, I told you, Jake. Water under the bridge. I just wanted to ask her something.
Okay.
She hears him call out to Blue, who comes to the phone and says,
Hi, Laurel. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Blue. I'm fine, how are you?
Oh, you know, busy, busy, as always.
There's a pause, and then Laurel says, Listen, Blue, I wanted to apologize for the way I reacted last time we spoke. I think I may have been a little over the top.
She can almost hear Blue shrug. Don't worry about it.
No, really, I'm sorry. And I suppose I just wanted to know more about why you thought, what you thought, when you met him.
You feel it too.
Laurel blanches and brings her hand to her throat. She feels horribly caught out. No, she says. No, it's... I just want to know what you think. That's all.
Blue sighs and continues.
Floyd has a dark aspect. Very dark. Dangerous, almost. But the discrepancy between his true self and the way he presents himself is striking. It's like he's taking cues from people, working out how to be. And then there's the way he is with his daughter. It's not quite right. He watches her all the time. Did you know that? You can almost see him prompting her under his breath. Like she's acting, too, and he's there to stop her making a mistake, to stop her exposing him for what he is. I don't think... She pauses. I don't think he really loves her. Not in the normal sense of the word. I think it's more that he needs her, because she makes him human. She's like a cloak. Laurel nods and makes an affirmative noise, although she is still processing what Blue has said.
But what you just said about him being dangerous, what do you mean by that?
I mean, says Blue, that a man who can't love but desperately needs to be loved is a dangerous thing indeed. And I think Floyd is dangerous because he's pretending to be someone he's not, in order to get you to love him.
Laurel shudders at Blue's words. They chime so completely with her own feelings yesterday, standing by the Christmas tree.
What about Poppy? She says. What did you make of Poppy?
Poppy is like a rainbow. Poppy is everything. But she needs to get away from her father before he starts taking her colours away.
There is a long pause. Then Laurel says,
Thank you, Blue. Thank you for your time.
She slowly slides her phone into her handbag and drives to work, feeling slightly numb. Chapter 56.
When Laurel gets to the office, she finds she's the only one not wearing a Christmas jumper.
Was there a memo?
She asks Helen.
Yes,
says Helen, who is wearing a jumper with flashing fairy lights somehow built into it and has red baubles hanging from her earrings.
Last week. It should be in your inbox.
Laurel sighs. She's sure it was. She's sure she must have read it, and then edited it out somewhere in the tangles of her life.
Here.
Helen throws her a piece of tinsel.
Put this in your hair.
Laurel twists the tinsel into her hair and smiles.
Thank you.
There are carolers in the shopping centre today. She can hear them from her desk. They're singing Good King Wenceslas. The management have invested in a job lot of mince pies from Waitrose, and at 5 p.m, there'll be Secret Santa and Sherry. She can't wait to get home. She goes into Waitrose on her way to her car that night, buys 2 bottles of champagne, 2 scented candles, and 2 boxes of chocolates. She'll work out what to give to whom tonight, when she's wrapping them. Everywhere she goes that day, she hears Blue's words of doom echoing portentously around her head. When she'd been talking to Blue this morning, she'd fully believed all she'd said. Yes, she'd thought.
Yes, this all makes perfect sense.
Of course Floyd has a dark aspect. Of course he's pretending to be someone he's not. But as the hours pass, and Floyd sends her silly, festive text messages adorned with Santa Claus emojis and bunches of holly, as the caroler's repertoire sinks into her psyche, and the sherry softens the edges of her consciousness, her fingers push the blades of the scissors back and forth through the shiny paper on her living room floor, and the lights of the neighbor's Christmas trees flash their reflections onto her windows, it starts to seem bizarre and dreadful.
What a strange girl Blue is, she thinks to herself, turning off her lights, slipping off her clothes, untwirling the tinsel from her hair. What a very strange girl indeed.
Chapter 57. Laurel rises late on Christmas Eve. She has 2 text messages from Floyd, one asking what to bring for Paul and Bonnie, the other asking what to wear. She types in a reply. Bring them cheese. The smellier, the better. And wear a nice jumper and a festive persona. I'm wearing green. He replies immediately. So, green cheese and a smelly jumper. I'm on it. Smiley face. Silly bugger, she replies. and then she has a shower. When she gets out of the shower, there is another message from him. Could you come here first, do you think? I have a gift for you, but it's too big to bring to the party. She feels a blade of dread pass through her. She's unsettled by his excitement about his gift to her. She's never been a fan of grand gestures. But more than that, she feels strange about this last-minute change of plans. Blue's words come back to her again. A man who can't love but desperately needs to be loved is a dangerous thing indeed. She remembers Floyd's lies about Noelle Donnelly's house, about her family. She thinks of Noelle's flat stomach at 8 months pregnant, and she thinks of the lip balm in Noelle Donnelly's basement. And then she thinks of the press cuttings in Floyd's study, and the candlesticks in Poppy's bedroom. And she knows. She knows without a doubt that Floyd is bringing her to his house for some ulterior purpose. She texts Paul, and she texts Hannah. I'm going to Floyd's on my way to Bonnie's, but I won't be late. If I am late, please call me immediately. If I don't answer my phone, please send someone to come for me. I'll be at 18 Latimer Road, N4. I'll explain everything later. Then she flicks back to Floyd's text. Okay, she types back. No problem. I'll come over when I'm ready. Fantastic, he replies. See you soon. She loads a car with wrapped gifts and champagne and leaves for Floyd's house at 11 a.m. A text arrives from Hannah. Mum? She doesn't reply. The roads are busy and slow. People pour out of the cinema at High Barnet. The high street is packed with shoppers, and there is a long-suffering reindeer in Highgate being petted by a crowd of children, while a glowering Father Christmas tries to control them. As she approaches Stroud Green, Laurel feels a lump form in the back of her throat. Every street corner, shop front and side road here holds a memory of Christmas's past. The annual pilgrimage for pizzas on Christmas Eve, where they pre-booked the same table every year. The last-minute run down to the pound shop on the high street for extra wrapping paper. The little park at the bottom of the road where they used to take the children after lunch to let off steam. The neighbours' doors that Laurel and the children would post cards through on Christmas morning. All of those messy Christmases, each a perfect gem. All gone. All turned to ash. She pulls into Floyd's Road and turns off her ignition. And then she stops for a moment, sits in her car, feeling the air chill as the heater dies down, watching the wind whip the bare branches of the trees overhead, waiting to feel ready to face Floyd. 5 minutes later, she takes a deep breath and heads toward his front door. Part 5. Chapter 58.
Laurel Mack. My God, what a woman. Dazzling. I could not believe that this woman was allowing me to put my hands upon her. That she was in my house. In my bed. She smelled like 5-star hotels. Her hair, under my fingertips, was like a satin sheet. Her skin was smooth and gleamed under the light. She tasted of icy winter mornings when my mouth was on hers. She held the back of my head hard against hers, those pretty hands entwined in my hair. She laughed when I joked. She smiled when I called her name. She spent an entire weekend in my home, and then another. She told her dying mother about me. She let me join her for a family birthday celebration. She sought their approval, and she got it. She took my daughter shopping. She cupped my buttocks as she passed me on the stairs. She woke up with her head on my chest, and she changed into my clothes and walked barefoot through my house, and drank coffee out of my mugs, and parked her car on my street, and kept coming back and coming back, and every time she came back, she was better than I remembered. And every time I saw her, she was more beautiful than I remembered.
and I spent every waking hour in a state of raw disbelief that a woman like her would want to be with a man like me. But now it is Christmas Eve, and I am sitting in my living room, trussed up in a Paul Smith jumper and a pair of trousers that are slightly too tight on me. Poppy is in her room wrapping gifts and choosing clothes. And Laurel is parked in her car on the street outside, and I can see the serious set of her face from my front window. I can see the way her jaw sits a millimeter offset, the slow blink of her eyelids, as she finds the strength to come into my home. Because I know, and now she knows it, too. I am not the man she thought I was. The doorbell rings, and I go to my door. Chapter 59. Floyd greets Laurel with a kiss on each cheek. She smiles brightly and says, "You look lovely. Really Christmassy." And he does. He looks handsome and jolly. The holly green of his jumper suits him. But under her chest, her heart races. Her breath comes tight and hard. "And you look beautiful as ever. I love your jacket."
"Thank you."
Laurel runs her hands down the silk velvet and forces another smile.
"Where's Poppy?"
"Upstairs," says Floyd, "wrapping your gift."
"Oh, bless her."
"Come in." He ushers her into the kitchen. "Come, I've got a bottle of champagne chilling. Can I interest you in a Buck's Fizz?" Laurel nods. A small drink will calm her nerves. Floyd seems tense too, she notices. Not his usual effortless self. She watches him closely as he pours her drink, checks that the glass is fresh from the cupboard, that he doesn't hide it from view, as he pours in first the champagne and then the orange juice. He raises a toast. "To you," says Floyd. "To wonderful, extraordinary you. You are the most remarkable person, I think, that I have ever known. I am honored to call you a friend. Cheers, Laurel Mac. Cheers." Laurel smiles tightly. She feels that she should reciprocate in some way, but all she can think of to say is, "Cheers. You're pretty fab too." Which sounds utterly pathetic. She glances upward to the ceiling.
"Is Poppy coming down?"
she says, her voice catching nervously on the last word. Floyd smiles at her.
"Should be,"
he replies simply.
"Should be."
"Here."
She hands him the bag with his gift in it.
"You may as well have this now, save taking it to Bonnie's."
He opens the shaving mirror, and he makes all the right noises and all the right gestures. And then he comes toward her with his arms outstretched, and she flinches as he hugs her, feels her breath catch, adrenaline pulsing through her. She is ready to push him from her, ready to escape. She can't imagine that she'd ever found this man's touch pleasing. She can't imagine she'd ever found this man anything other than terrifying.
"Here,"
he says,
handing her an envelope. "Open that first. I'm just popping out to my car to get your other gift."
"Oh," she says. "Okay."
He stops in the doorway and looks at her. A small smile plays on his lips.
"Goodbye,"
he says. She hears the front door open and close. The house, now that Floyd has gone, is completely silent. She glances down at the card in front of her, and she opens it. It has a picture on the front of a dove in flight. It is strangely un-Christmassy. Inside the card is a letter. She begins to read.
"Laurel.
I sense that you are tiring of me. I sense that you have worked out what 100 women before you have worked out. That I'm not the man for them. That is fine. Because I have worked out that I am not worthy of you. And that I must let you go. And before I let you go, I must also unburden myself of an appalling, unthinkable truth. I have something of yours. It was not given to me. Rather, bequeathed to me in a terrible sequence of events. I need you to know that when I first came into possession of this precious thing, it had been horribly abused by another person, and for 5 years, I have tended and cared for this possession. I have polished it, and nurtured it. And now it is time to return it to you. I'm glad we had this time together. Time for you to see me not as a monster, but as a normal man. A man worthy of your affections. If only for a few short weeks. It has been an extraordinary experience for me, after so many years in an emotional wasteland. A precious gift. I cannot thank you enough. And I am glad you have had a chance to get to know me, to hopefully view me as a man capable of being trusted with your most precious possession. My study door is unlocked. On my desktop computer, I have left you a video message. Simply press play and I will explain everything. Yours. Always and in good faith. Floyd Dunn. Laurel rests the card on the table and looks through the kitchen door. Slowly, she walks toward Floyd's study. She sits in Floyd's chair and grasps the mouse tentatively. As she touches it, the screen comes to life, and there is Floyd, dressed in the same jumper he wore this morning, his face paused in an expression of terrible grief. She clicks the play button, and she watches his confession. Chapter 60. Laurel, there are so many things I want you to know. But the first is this. When I walked into that cafe in November, when I chose the table next to yours, when I complimented you on your hair and invited you to share my cake, I was not trying to seduce you. You were far too beautiful and far too delicate, and I would never have been so presumptuous. Everything that happened after that meeting was entirely unexpected, and I can see now, with hindsight, horribly, horribly selfish. Earlier this year, I switched on the TV to watch the news, and there was a trailer for the show coming up afterward. Crime Watch. Not a show I'd normally watch. Not my thing at all. But they said they'd be staging a reconstruction of the disappearance of a girl called Ellie Mack. And then a picture of Ellie Mack appeared on the screen, and my heart stopped. The missing girl looked exactly like Poppy. Older than Poppy, but exactly like her. So I sat and watched the show. It's been 10 years since Ellie Mack, a 15-year-old from North London, disappeared on her way to the library, the presenter said. Ellie was a popular girl, well-liked at school, in a happy relationship with her boyfriend of 8 months, and the beloved heart and soul of her family. According to her teachers, she was set for a full house of A's and A-stars in the GCSE exams she was sitting that month. There appeared to be no obvious reason why this smiley, charmed girl should leave her home one Thursday morning and not return. We first launched an appeal for witnesses to Ellie's disappearance in 2005. That appeal was unsuccessful. Now, 10 years on, with no sightings of Ellie and no evidence to suggest her abduction, we have staged a reconstruction. But first, here's Ellie's mum and dad, Laurel and Paul Mack, to remind us of the girl they haven't seen for 10 long years. The footage shifted from the presenter to a video of a tired-looking couple sitting side by side in a very nice kitchen, She had a sheet of vanilla blonde hair, cut sharp at the ends, and clipped back on one side. She wore a black polo neck with the sleeves pushed back. A simple watch. No rings. He was a classic city boy. Pale blue shirt unbuttoned at the neck. Thick, graying hair parted at the side. Short at the back and longer on top. A soft, spoon-fed face that was probably steam-shaved in Jermyn Street twice a week. It was you and Paul. You started talking first, to someone off-camera who had been edited out. Your voice was serious and mature, like a newsreader. And you had the same broad forehead and wide-set eyes as Ellie and Poppy. I could see the line that went straight down through the three of you. It was breathtaking. You talked about the golden light of your girl, the journey she'd been taking to the stars when she went, the laughter and the dreams, the lasagna she'd asked you to save for her lunch on her return. Your eyes turned to glass as you talked. You circled your narrow wrists with your thumb and fingers. You had beautiful hands. Long, elegant, feminine. Paul started to talk then. I don't mean to be rude, but I could tell that he was a flibbertigibbet. Well-meaning, but ultimately pointless. And I could tell that you were no longer a couple. Your body language was all off. He talked about the bond he'd had with his daughter. With all of his children, he hastened to add. How she'd been an open book. Always told her parents everything. Didn't have any secrets. His eyes also turned to glass and flicked briefly toward you. He was hoping, desperately, I could tell, for some reassurance. But he did not get it. While you spoke, pictures flashed up at intervals of Ellie. As a child at the foot of a plastic slide. On the back of a speedboat with her father's arm around her. The wind in her hair. On Christmas Day in a silly hat. And in a restaurant with her arm around an elderly lady who looked likely to be a grandmother. The girl looked far too alive to be dead, I thought. Even in those slightly blurred photographs, I could feel the essence of her, sense the sheer joy of her. But it was a coincidence, I persuaded myself. That's all it was. A young girl with a fairly commonplace name who'd disappeared a year before Poppy was born and bore a striking resemblance to her. Then the interview faded out, and the reenactment began. And that was when I knew. That was when all the little pieces of the puzzle fell into place. And I knew it was no coincidence. There was the high road. The cafe on the corner of Noel's Road. The Red Cross shop where she bought her nasty clothes. The camera panned across the street and I could even see the distant bloom of cherry blossom on the tree outside her house. My skin covered over with goosebumps. Because, you see, Noelle had told me once in a fit of anger that she was not Poppy's real mother. That a girl called Ellie had had her baby for her. I hadn't been sure at the time if it was her madness that had caused her to say such a thing or if it might in fact be true. I had never seen her naked while pregnant. She had not allowed me to touch her. But still, it seemed far-fetched. I hadn't given it too much credence. And if it had in fact been true, then I'd always imagined the mythical Ellie as a desperate addict, some loser that Noelle had picked up off the street and thrown some money at to carry her fake child for her. But here, on my TV screen, was a beautiful young girl with her whole life ahead of her, vanished off the face of the earth and last seen virtually outside Noelle's house. This was not a child who would have left her family behind, her boyfriend, and her future, to willingly bear a baby for a stranger. And this sent my thoughts spiraling back to those days after Noelle's disappearance, when I'd gone to her house to collect Poppy's things.
I'd thought of the weird basement room I told you about. Nothing in it but the stained old sofa bed, the dead hamsters, the TV with built-in VCR, the three locks on the door. And I knew immediately that Noelle was capable of stealing a child. And I knew immediately what I needed to do.
Chapter 61.
You know, Laurel, all my life, all I ever wanted was to feel like everyone else. I'd turn up in some different country at some new school, and I'd see all the kids who'd grown up together, whose mums and dads all drank wine together at the weekends. All these laid-back kids with their in-jokes and their basement dens and their nicknames. And I'd look at them and think, how do you do that? How does that even work? I was never anywhere long enough to get a nickname. I was just the new boy. Every couple of years, hey, you, new boy. And being a virtual fucking genius didn't really do me any favors, either. Nobody likes a clever clogs. And I was a terrible clever clogs. My cleverness oozed out of me like goo. Also, I was not good-looking in the least. Plus, bad at sports and completely disinterested. And of course I had these high-flying parents who clearly didn't think there was any sacrifice too big for the sakes of their careers, who genuinely didn't seem to realize that children liked being with their parents. They threw activities at me and told themselves that as long as I was busy, I must surely be happy. There was one school, one town in Germany. I liked that school. It was an international school. Kids from all over the world. A lot of them couldn't even speak English. And a transient intake. Kids coming and going all the time. So for once, I had an advantage. I could speak English. And I was there for nearly 4 years, from 11 to 14. So I started off as one of the youngest and became one of the oldest. This was good stuff. Formative. Almost transformative. I'd see new kids arrive. Little ones, foreign ones, tiny little Korean kids or Indian kids or Nigerian kids, struggling with the language, struggling with the culture shock. And that made me feel normal. I had a girlfriend there, Mathilde. She was French, quite pretty. We kissed a few times, and maybe if my parents hadn't dragged me away by the scruff of my neck at that precise moment and dropped me down in the next place, maybe I'd have had a chance to develop that normality, become a guy with a core and a soul. As it is, I don't think I ever really loved anyone until Poppy came along. And even now I'm not sure if that's quite the right word. After all, I have nothing to compare it to. Why didn't I go straight to the police after seeing Ellie on Crime Watch? That's what you'd like to know, isn't it? And it's a very good question. Firstly, at this juncture, I did not know whether Ellie was dead or alive. I did not know how long she'd been in Noelle's basement, assuming she had ever been there. And according to the TV show, there was a slim possibility that she'd let herself into your house 4 years after her disappearance and helped herself to some cash and valuables. So Ellie was potentially anywhere or nowhere, and the narrative was all over the place. But that, in itself, was not a good enough reason to stop me telling the police what little I knew. You see, what concerned me the most was my role in this scenario. Another thing that Noelle told me the day she told me that she wasn't Poppy's real mother was that I was not Poppy's real father. She told me that the baby had been conceived using sperm she'd bought off the internet. I'd locked this unpalatable little nugget away with all the other stuff she told me,
and stuck my head in the sands of denial. Poppy was literally, Laurel, literally the only good thing that had ever happened to me. My pride and joy. My entire raison d'être. You know how difficult my relationship with Sarah has always been. You know how she hated me as a child, spat in my face, bit me, and scratched me. I thought that was what fatherhood was. I thought that was the child I deserved. And then Poppy came into my life, and she was so exquisite, and so clever, and she adored me. For the first time in my life, I had something beautiful and precious that nobody else had. Nobody in the world. And if she wasn't mine, then my life no longer made any sense to me. But after watching the Crime Watch special, I realized that if she was mine, and if I told the police what I knew about Noelle and Ellie, that there would be no police officer, no detective, no judge, and no juror that would ever, in a million years, believe that Ellie had been impregnated with my sperm without my knowledge or consent. It was preposterous. Clearly. I would be done, at the very least, for aiding and abetting. And I would be done for rape of a minor. A minor that I'd never even met. But again, I prevaricated. I did not get a DNA test done, even though proof that Poppy was not genetically my child would free me to report what I knew to the police. I simply wasn't ready to let her go, Laurel. I'm so sorry. Shortly after the Crime Watch special, I read an interview with you in The Guardian. It was some kind of real-life interest story in the magazine. You said, and I quote, "The nightmare of the thing is the not knowing. The lack of closure. I just cannot move forward without knowing where my daughter is. It's like walking through sinking mud. I can see something on the horizon, but I can never, ever, get to it. It's a living death." And then, a month later, there were the headlines in the papers. Ellie's remains found. You had your closure. I came to the funeral. I stood at a respectful remove. I saw your legs buckle as your husband helped you into the crematorium, and saw them buckle again on the way out. Closure, it seemed, had brought you nothing but a box of bones. But I could give you something that would get you out of the sinking mud, and walking toward the horizon. I could give you Poppy. Chapter 62. I became fixated on you, Laurel. I raked the internet for articles about you, for photographs and clips of the press conference you'd given the day after Ellie disappeared. You were such a refined woman. So succinct and articulate. No words wasted. No emotional incontinence. Your pretty hands always twisted together so intricately. The sharply cut hair, the tailored clothes. No lace or buttons or trim. Even in your clothing choices, you wasted nothing. And in watching you, I became more and more familiar with Paul. The shirts looked conventional at first sight, until you realized that there was a contrast trim of Liberty print inside the collar. The cufflinks that appeared to be tiny dog heads. The slightly unusual tortoiseshell glasses. A flash of geometric printed silk sock inside a handmade shoe. Further investigation of such clothing showed that he shopped primarily at Paul Smith and Ted Baker. I began experimenting with a pair of socks here and a silk handkerchief there. Then I took myself for a proper shave in a barber shop. I had never before had a proper shave. In fact, I rarely shaved. I tended to let the stubble grow out until my face itched, scratch it all off with a generally blunt razor, leave myself with a blotchy, butchered face, and then let it all grow back again. Clothes shopping for me was a joyless affair, a whiz around M&S with a basket twice a year. I began to enjoy browsing these boutiques for gentlemen. I liked the snake-tipped sales assistants, so eager to help, to guide me in the right direction. Then, I had a proper haircut, found some products that gave my rather sparse and gravity-challenged hair the appearance of volume and lift, bought a pair of clear-lens glasses with horn frames, and the transformation was complete. It was a gradual process, over the course of a couple of months. It wasn't as if I just suddenly popped up one day with a brand new image like one of those awful TV makeover shows. I'm not sure anyone I saw regularly even noticed. I just wanted to show myself to you, and for you to like me. That's all it was. For you to find me familiar. To find me the kind of person with whom you could share a slice of cake. I wanted us to be friends, and then I wanted you and Poppy to be friends. Because now I had had a DNA test done. By now I knew, with only 0.02% of a chance of improbability, that Poppy was not my child. And that the only person she truly belonged to was you. I had not expected mutual attraction. I had not expected your hands inside the sleeves of my jumper in the restaurant, our desperate ascent up the stairs of my house that night, your head in the crook of my arm the following morning. Women like you did not like men like me. And I... No. There's no defense for it. None. I took advantage. Plain and simple. But I'm glad at least that you and Poppy have had a chance to get to know each other, in relatively normal circumstances. Not in the glare of a police operation. Not in the strip-lit office of the social services. Just as a child. And her grandmother. Sharing breakfast. Going shopping. Eating dinner with your family. I hope this means that in the days that follow, Poppy will be seamlessly assimilated into the Mac family. I've given her the bare bones of the truth. I will leave it to you to decide how much more she needs to know. And remember, this house and everything in it belongs to Poppy. She'll more than pay her own way in life. But that brings me to the final, and in some ways most compelling reason for me not going straight to the police back in May of this year. You'll notice if you look through the window to your right that there is a flower bed in the garden. Newer. Higher than the others. Do you see? At the very back. I dug it out in early November. Just before I met you. Noelle Donnelly is under there. Before that, she was in a chest freezer in my cellar. She'd been in there since the night she told me about Ellie. The night she told me Poppy wasn't mine. I didn't mean to kill her, Laurel. I promise you that. It was an accident. I went for her. I wanted to scare her. I wanted to hurt her. I mean, you can imagine, can't you? How I was feeling with that woman. That evil woman in my kitchen, ripping my heart out of my chest. If you had been there, you'd have wanted to hurt her too. I know you would. But I did not intend to kill her. Her chair went flying and her head hit the floor and... Anyway, I'll let you decide if you want to tell the police. If you want to tell Poppy. But I couldn't go without telling someone, and I know whatever you decide to do, it will be the right thing. Please, Laurel, forgive me. Forgive me for everything. Forgive me for meeting Noelle, for allowing her into my life. Forgive me for not questioning her more when she was pregnant, for not asking more questions about the basement in her house, for not going to the police when I suspected who Poppy's mother was, for allowing myself to fall in love with you, for taking these last few weeks with you that were not mine to be taken. Please forgive me. The horizon is right in front of you, Laurel. March to it right now, with Poppy by your side.
Chapter 63. The film stops. Silence subsumes the house once more. A quick glance through the front window tells Laurel that Floyd's car is gone, and that so, by extension, is he. She returns to Floyd's office and stares at the ceiling. A choking noise comes from somewhere deep inside her. Her baby. Her baby girl. Not tramping the back roads of England with a rucksack on her back, but locked in Noelle Donnelly's basement, growing a baby for her. How long was she there for? How was she treated? How did she die? And how could Laurel not have known? How many times had she walked those streets in the years after Ellie's disappearance? How many times had she passed that house, her eye caught by the puff of pink cherry blossom outside Noelle's basement window? How many times had she been but meters from her own daughter, without somehow, through some powerful umbilical connection, feeling that she was there? Tears of rage explode from her, and she thumps Floyd's desk until her fists feel bruised. She's about to yell out again when she hears a sound behind her, the creak of the door to Floyd's study. It opens a crack, and there is Poppy. She's wearing the little jersey and chiffon dress that Laurel bought her in H&M during their shopping expedition. Her hair is bunched inside her fist, and she has a hairband and a hairbrush in her other hand.
"I've been trying to do a ponytail," Poppy says, moving toward her. "A high, swingy one. But I can't get it high enough, and it keeps going all bumpy on the top."
Laurel smiles and gets up from her chair.
"Here,"
she says, turning it toward Poppy. "You sit here. I'll see what I can do. No, it's been a very long time since I did a high ponytail." Poppy sits and passes Laurel the hairband and the hairbrush. Laurel takes the bunched hair from her other hand and starts to brush it. She finds that the act is embedded in her muscle memory. How many mornings, how many times, how many ponytails has she brushed into place? And now it seems her hairbrushing days are not behind her after all. Now it seems that she is a mother again. Something warm and delicate inside her chest opens up, like an unfurling flower.
"Where's Dad?" says Poppy.
"Dad's not here," says Laurel carefully. "He's had to go somewhere." Poppy nods.
"Is it to do with what he told me last night?"
"What did he tell you last night?"
"He told me that Noelle wasn't my mum. He told me that your daughter was."
She turns, suddenly, and Laurel can see that her eyes are red and swollen, that she has been crying silently in her bedroom.
"Is it true? Is it true that you're my grandma?"
Laurel pauses. She swallows. "Would you like it to be true?" Poppy nods again. "Well, it is. Your mother was called Ellie. She was my daughter. And she was the most wonderful, golden, perfect girl in the world. And you, Poppy, are exactly like her." Poppy says nothing for a moment, and then she turns to Laurel once more, her eyes wide with fear, and says,
"Is she dead?"
Laurel nods.
"Is my dad dead?"
"Your dad?"
My real dad.
You mean?
The man who made a baby with Ellie. Not my dad who brought me up.
Your dad told you?
Yes. He told me. He said he doesn't know who my real dad is. He says no one knows. Not even you.
Laurel turns her attention back to Poppy's hair. She pulls it as high as she can, and then she twists the elastic band around it 3 times.
I don't know if your real dad is dead, Poppy. It's possible we'll never know.
Poppy is silent for a moment. Then she says,
Have you finished?
Yes, says Laurel.
All done.
Poppy slides from the chair and goes to the mirror on the wall outside Floyd's study. She touches her hair with her fingertips in her reflection.
Do I look like her?
She says.
Yes. You look just like her.
She turns back to her reflection and appraises it again, her chin tipped up slightly.
Was she pretty?
She was extraordinarily pretty.
Was she as pretty as Hannah?
Laurel is about to say, Oh, she was much prettier than Hannah. But catches herself.
Yes, she says.
She was as pretty as Hannah. Poppy looks satisfied with this.
Are we still going to the party?
She says.
Do you want to?
Yes. I want to see my family.
She says.
I want to see my real family.
In which case, then definitely.
Laurel?
Yes, sweetheart?
Is Dad ever coming back?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Poppy glances down at her shoes, and then back at Laurel. Her eyes fill with tears, and suddenly the unnerving stoicism passes, and Poppy is sobbing, her shoulders heaving up and down, her hands pressed hard into her eye sockets. Laurel takes her in her arms, holds her tight, kisses the top of her head, feels her love for this child flow through her like a sudden, glorious summer storm.
Chapter 64.
I have both my passport and a handgun. I have a change of clothes in a small bag and a fully charged phone. My plan is to get as far away from London N4 as I can and then either blow out my brains or leave the country. I will see how I feel when it comes down to it. At this juncture, I have no idea what is worse, to break my daughter's heart, and then spend the rest of my life either in hiding or in jail. Plan B, at least, does not involve a funeral. And so finally, I have cleared up your shitty, disgusting mess, Noelle. As I speak, or think, or write, or whatever the hell it is I'm doing with a dead person, Laurel will be introducing herself anew to her granddaughter, and then they will go together to the twinkling Richard Curtis Christmas meal in the twinkling Muse House in twinkling Belsize Park. And imagine everyone's faces, Noelle, when they walk in together, those two fine women with their strong brows and their big brains and all that golden light dazzling the bejesus out of everyone. Just imagine. I wish I could be there to see it. But I denied myself that privilege when I chose my own happiness and my own needs over Laurel's. I'm out of London now, Noelle. I appear to be heading west. Yep, there goes Slough. And I'm feeling good. In fact, I'm feeling amazing. I finally shed you. Like a dead skin.
I tucked the gun in the innocuous Sainsbury's carrier bag on the passenger seat. I caress its solid lines, feel the cool of the metal through the plastic. I imagine the barrel of the gun hard against the roof of my mouth, the pressure of the trigger against my fingertip. The day is still bright and clean. I imagine myself pulling off the road a few hours hence and driving into a dark-skied, sleepy Cornish village, finding a bed for the night, or sleeping in my car. Tomorrow I would awake, and it would be Christmas Day. The world would fall silent, as it always does at Christmas, all those big, loud lives sucked up behind a million closed doors. And where would I go? Where would I be? And the day after that? And the day after that? I feel clean and pure, purged and new. I have just done the best and greatest thing I have ever done or ever will do. Do I want to be here when this breaks in the newspapers? Really? Christ, just imagine the terrifying photographs they would dig out of the two of us. Fred and Rose West would look like Brangelina in comparison. I pass the Glastonbury Tor. The sun is beginning its descent and the sky is pearly grey. Pale gold light shines off the stones, and a few sightseers are thrown into delicate silhouette. I pull off the M5 at the next junction and make my way back to the Tor. A road back, I find a field. From here I can watch the sunset, can see the shadows of the Glastonbury stones shrink and grow in the changing light. I think of Laurel and Poppy in the flickering candlelight of Bonnie's dining table, of their faces, open and bright. And then I think again of you and me, inextricably linked for infinity, our faces side by side on the front pages of the newspapers for years to come. And I know that I do not want to be here to see that. I think of Poppy, of her brave face as I held her hand in her bedroom last night and told her the truth about herself, the solid set of her chin as she bit back on her emotions, the tiny nod of her head as she silently absorbed words that no 9-year-old girl should ever have to hear. I think of how she will learn to live without me, and I know that she will. I know that she will flourish. I think of my parents in Washington, the purse of their lips, the unspoken words going through both of their minds. We should have left him in the hospital. And I know that this will be my last sunset. This one, here, right now on Christmas Eve, playing out in violent flames of red and gold across the horizon. And I know that these are my last moments. And that is fine. That is absolutely fine. I put my hand into the plastic bag, and I take out the gun. Chapter 65. 8 months later. Theo and Hannah walk hand in hand through a bower of white roses and baby's breath. Petals of pastel-colored confetti float around their heads, and a tinny recording of church bells peels across the urban streets of Finsbury Park. For a brief moment, the sun breaks through the bank of clouds that's been brooding overhead since early this morning. Laurel holds Poppy's hand in hers, and watches as her newly married daughter greets her friends and well-wishers on the street outside the church. Hannah's in pure white, and her hair glitters with gems. She looks glowing and golden. Her husband stands beside her, handsome and assured, his hand resting gently on the small of her back, his face bursting with pride. How? She wonders. Could she have ever thought that Hannah would be Theo's consolation prize? How? She wonders. Could she have allowed herself ever to feel that way? After a short while, the wedding party, only 30 strong, climbs aboard an old red Routemaster bus. Poppy sits on Laurel's knee, her hand still clutching the bouquet she'd carried into the church in her role as a flower girl. Laurel loops her arms around Poppy's waist and holds on to her as the bus lurches forward. Poppy calls her